Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Historian Douglas Brinkley this hour on Walter Cronkite. Early in the book, these words are found. Since the CBS heyday of Murrow in the 1950s, no TV broadcaster had been so omnipresent in American life as Cronkite. He was as familiar to TV watchers as the star-spangled banner at the end of late-night programming before the static ruled. Whether it was chronicling astronaut John Glenn's orbit of the Earth, lamenting the JFK assassination, sharing his post-Tet Offensive doubts about the Vietnam War, dubbing the Chicago police a bunch of thugs at the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, or celebrating the nation's bicentennial, Cronkite was the clarion voice in network news. And he may have been a person we really needed when he announced on November 22nd of 1963, this news.
This is Walter Cronkite in our newsroom, and there has been an attempt, as perhaps you know now, on the life of President Kennedy. He was wounded in an automobile driving from Dallas Airport into downtown Dallas, along with Governor Connally of Texas. They've been taken to Parkland Hospital there, where their condition is as yet unknown. We have not been told their condition at Dallas. In the downtown hotel room, a group had been gathered to hear President Kennedy when he was waiting his arrival. Let's switch down there now, where Eddie Barker of KRLD is on the air. From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
Douglas Brinkley is the author of Cronkite. He is a historian at Rice University and a contributing editor to Vanity Fair. He's written other books as well, The Quiet World, The Wilderness Warrior, and The Great Deluge. This is an extremely thorough biography of him, and it is titled Cronkite. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Douglas Brinkley, hello.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. I have gone to YouTube to see Walter Cronkite announce the assassination of Kennedy a couple times in the last couple days as I have been reading your book. And I've got to tell you, I am still reduced to tears every time I see it. And I saw him in 63 announce that news. But there's something about the way he did it, the enormity of that event, and who he was and what he had seen, and now, from the hindsight of history, what he was yet to see, that always gets me. And I'm not alone in that, am I?
No, you're not. And remember, the Kennedy assassination came in 1963, really when TV was starting to become a phenomenon, meaning most homes had televisions by 63. Cronkite had gotten very well known during the early 60s for his coverage of Alan Shepard and John Glenn in 61 and 62, and he became the first half-an-hour nightly news broadcast in September of 63 with CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. It's only a couple months after the premiere when the news went from 15 to 30 on a Friday. Cronkite had brought in his pineapple and cottage cheese lunch and was just sitting there at the newsroom in New York when all of this commotion from Dallas started coming through the ticker tapes and through the phone. And it's not just the announcing of the Kennedy assassination that people remember, but Cronkite was sort of our pastor-in-chief or rabbi that entire weekend. He reported where Lyndon Johnson was and how he was sworn in and why was Jackie Kennedy still wearing a pink Chanel suit with blood on it. What's happened to the Kennedy kids? Where will John F. Kennedy's body be buried, in Massachusetts or in Arlington? What world dignitaries are coming to the funeral? On and on. We tuned in a communal way with Cronkite playing sort of our national healer through those dark days of November of 63.
Isn't that a remarkable role for somebody? And I think you chose exactly the right words. He was a national healer. He was a healer during that time, a television news broadcaster who had this incredibly important role in the history of this country, really.
Well, he did. It's really remarkable. And, you know, in many countries, when your world, when your national leader gets murdered the way Kennedy was, you know, you have riots in the streets. In America, we turned on Cronkite. And it's a, I try to write in the biography just the power of the medium of TV by the late 50s and early 60s. I mean, it went from very few people having a television in 1950 when Cronkite really started on the air for CBS. But by 1960, it was the talk of the nation, and everybody had one. It wasn't just one set on the block. Most people were acquiring television. Yet there were only, at best, three channels. Most areas in the country only got CBS and NBC. And I was stunned at how many, particularly rural areas, only got CBS. I mean, Cronkite became the source of news delivery, and this whole idea of breaking news that we live with today, that in any minute there'll be a flash bulletin, really started with Cronkite.
Mm-hmm. I was fascinated by his reporting in World War II for United Press and how he had opportunities to do radio with Edward R. Murrow, but he was a print guy first and foremost, and it probably governed the way that he later did radio and later did television as well. He wanted the facts. He wanted them delivered in a clear fashion, in an interesting fashion, and he was a worker. He really, I think you say at one point, he didn't have much of a vacation from, 1941 to, he went years and years and years just reporting the war.
Well, he did. He was a work beast, and always wanted to be, you know, very successful, very driven, and he considered broadcasting a trade or a craft, and he always tried to be better at it. But he connected it more than anybody else, I think, on TV with the print world. You know, he started as a journalism writer in high school in Houston, Texas, and went on to University of Texas in Austin, and then was hired by the United Press, one of the wire services. And the reason why the wire services, meaning AP or UP or what's today UPI or Reuters, something like that, is actually very good for broadcast journalism is you're forced to be succinct. I mean, you have to really be like Ernest Hemingway and keep your prose tight because you have a limited amount of space in the print UP wire copy, and you have a limited amount of time on TV. And then those press people, to their credit, the wire services are were and are now today extremely well reported. And so Cronkite on television had a long career because he never tried to be first. He would wait till he had a couple of confirmations from the wires before he would break news. So that meant he got, you know, if you're playing the game of who came first, sometimes NBC would beat him by 2 or 3 minutes, sometimes by 10 minutes. But Cronkite never got it wrong, and so he was able to create a career that lasted for decades, not years.
There's a lesson that we need to pay attention to right now, right? Let's not
it
be
really
first.
Is.
Let's get it right.
That was the key, and he used to say, Cronkite, look, boys, it's my face hanging out there.
Right.
I'll be the one that says it wrong. It may have been written by a scriptwriter. It might have come from some other source, but it's going to be Cronkite's blunder. And he was a stern taskmaster when it came to being factual. Even on his drama show in the 50s called You Are There, when Walter Cronkite would interview people from our past like Louis Pasteur, Napoleon Bonaparte. It was very kitschy. And I didn't ever realize it was so deeply fact-checked that it actually is used even today some as a model in schools because there are no mistakes in those You Are There shows. That's part of the Cronkite ethic at work.
Well, I'll have to look some of those up as a result of this interview and your book. He was a brave guy. He went on some missions where he could easily have been shot down during World War II and wanted to serve himself as a combat soldier, but he was colorblind.
Well, exactly. You know, Cronkite's a Dutch name, and he had a great deal of pride in his Dutch heritage. And so when the Nazis took over Rotterdam and great bombing of Rotterdam and Walter Cronkite was in Kansas City with his wife, Betsy, and who had earned her pilot's license, and he had not because, as you say, he was colorblind. He wanted to get in the game. We had to do something about the fascist Nazi, you know, menace. And Cronkite joined the Foreign Correspondence Corps. Now, in World War II, today you have embedded reporters, and they just wear their normal clothes. Back in World War II, a foreign correspondent would wear a uniform, and Cronkite got his uniform, credentials in New York City, and then went on to cover everything from North Africa to working on Atlantic convoys to finally getting a spot in London where he became known as the Dean of the Air War. He embedded with the bomber pilots, particularly the 8th Air Force near Cambridge, England, and he would not only write about these extraordinary bomber pilots that were trying to destroy Nazi factories and ports with their bomb payloads, but he actually went on missions and was almost killed in one and had to take over the guns. I write in the book, because I have really 1,000 letters between Walter Cronkite and his wife, Betsy, saved from World War II, which were a primary source trove for me. But he went on and was at the Battle of the Bulge. He crashed on a glider in a Dutch potato field. He really was either in the just on the periphery or in the mix in all those key moments in the battle for Europe. And Cronkite, to his credit, always said, look, I wasn't a soldier. He didn't like it when he had to do public speeches and people treated him as a hero of World War II because he had seen too many men that had died. People that went on 100 bombing missions. He went on a few. So he was very self-deprecating, as members of the so-called greatest generation are apt to be.
I love this description of him, too, because it says a lot about the measure of the person. I mean, he wasn't a saint, but we'll get to some of the unsaintly acts. But the fact that he, as you write, kept in contact with Dutch friends that he made around VE Day, he kept in touch with them his whole life.
You know, nobody has ever mentioned this to me before like you just had, and it's really a key. I came into this biography wide-eyed. I wanted to find who this man was that we all grew up with. And I'll tell you, he really is a person who made friends. It was part of his gregarious nature. Dan Rather told me in a sneering way that Walter would talk to a potted plant, meaning he would talk to anybody. And truly, he did, and he made friends with everybody. And I don't know how he did it. He would stay in touch with people, write them letters, take all their phone calls, and he built this massive amount of friends. So when he died, it wasn't just a celebrity dying or a great newsman. People really thought they lost their uncle, Uncle Walter, or they lost one of their closest friends. Most significantly, and I didn't write about this as much as I could, he became probably his closest friend owned the Holiday Inn down at Cape Canaveral, where all the space missions were. And his name was Henry, and Henry was a survivor of the concentration camps of World War II. And Walter and him became truly great friends. And Henry Landsworth's his name, and he would come up to New York City and live with the Cronkites, and then Cronkite would live at his Holiday Inn.
Oh. In the wide range of friendships, you spend part of the book talking about Thanksgiving drumming sessions with a drummer for the Grateful Dead.
Well, Walter had a high tolerance for eccentricity,
right.
And not everybody does. He liked, and part of it was he didn't like phonies, so he loved people that were genuine characters, that were kind of true in their own skin, and he befriended Mickey Hart, the drummer of the Grateful Dead, much younger than him, but they had a great shared love of drumming. And Walter Cronkite played clarinet when he was young, but fell in love with sort of Buddy Rich and big band drumming. And so here's Mickey Hart of the Dead, by all accounts, one of our country's finest drummers. And they shared an interest in the history of drumming. And Hart would buy drums from Bolivia or Peru, from China, and give them to Walter for gifts. So in Cronkite's living room, he had 17 different drum sets from around the world, all given to him by Mickey Hart of the Grateful Dead. Then later, and now Walter's in his 80s, he would go into the Grateful Dead soundboard rooms, mixing studios, and with that wonderful voice of his, they would record Walter reading things, you know, like, what a beautiful day it is today, but they would put a rap beat behind it. And so you have Walter Cronkite's rap CDs. These were not made for public consumption. They're just privately having some fun, but it shows the Mickey Hart friendship, how Cronkite could reach across what seems like large canals, but would embrace friends. Friendship to him was something very holy and special and didn't have a prescribed formula to it. Many of his friends were conservatives, and he was a man of the left. He was great friends with William Buckley, yet Walter Cronkite was, by all accounts, a left liberal.
And there were certain issues that he really cared about, and those were obviously space was one of them, civil rights was another. What else would we put on that list?
Well, civil rights was very high. There was zero prejudice in Walter Cronkite, and when he became a half-an-hour news broadcast, Cronkite started doing the back-end stories of Martin Luther King and allowing opening up a Southern bureau where you'd have people like Bill Plant and Roger Mudd, Dan Rather, Nelson Benton, all doing these incredible stories about which were anti-Jim Crow bits. In many ways, CBS helped change the public consciousness. By the late 60s and early 70s, it was the environment. And if you had to pick a cause that Walter Cronkite believed in, it was a green planet. Mm. He would never say no to any kind of eco fundraiser. And he's really the progenitor of Earth Day, because once we got these photographs back from NASA and showed lonely, holy planet Earth floating up there, you know, the blue-green planet, it was almost spiritual to many of the astronauts that Cronkite talked to. And Walter put this picture of Earth called Earthrise behind him in his office and at his home in Martha's Vineyard. And then he used it as the bumper slide on CBS Evening News. But then he started running regularly a segment called Can We Save the Planet? And he would show the ugly effects of the Santa Barbara oil spill or how dangerous nuclear waste could be. And this was all being brought into people's rooms, the dead fish and the polluted rivers, in Technicolor, because by 1967, you know, color television was the rage. And we are now seeing beautiful America being so horribly polluted that those Cronkite reports started helping to change a consciousness in the country, which led to the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency.
Remarkable. Tell the story, because I think sometimes what happens to us when we're very young stays with us for a long time. When you discuss Jim Crow, the visit that the Cronkite family and what Cronkite's father did, I can't remember who they were visiting, but they were invited to a fellow dentist's home or somebody, and the experience of a young African-American who came to that doorstep. It's a remarkable story.
Well, the Cronkites, you know, or the both sides, maternal and paternal, Walter Cronkite's family came from Missouri, and they were very pro-integrationist. And so when they moved to Houston, Texas in 1927, it was booming in Houston. In fact, no bank foreclosed during the Great Depression in Houston, Texas. So in some ways it was the right move, go from Kansas City to Houston where the, you know, pastures look greener. But the Cronkites didn't realize they were walking into a deeply Jim Crow, race hate town of Houston. In fact, the KKK was extremely strong in Houston, Texas. And on one of their first nights in town, Walter Cronkite's father was a dentist, and he moved to Texas to work for Texas Dental College. But they went to his boss's house for dinner, and an African-American tried to deliver ice cream up the front door. There was no refrigeration in those days in homes. And then he got the N-word hurled at him nonstop in a vicious fashion because he went up the front porch to deliver the ice cream, didn't go to the back door. Mm-hmm. And Walter Cronkite grabbed his son, young Walter. Walter Cronkite Sr. grabbed his son and his wife and said, "We're leaving." And they just marched out of this house and walked home. And it was a moment seared in the future anchorman's life that his father knew that it's not enough just not to have bigotry in your heart, but you can't tolerate it around you.
Yeah, it's quite a story. We're talking about Walter Cronkite this hour of the program, and our guest is the author of such a thorough and fascinating biography of this man. Douglas Brinkley is our guest. The book is Cronkite. We welcome phone calls, and we'll take them momentarily. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York on this, the first broadcast of network television's first daily half-hour news program. In Alabama today, Governor Wallace.
Walter Cronkite, the focus of our conversation. Before we go to phone calls, I found it fascinating, and I want to time myself at some point because I don't know how fast I speak, that Walter had speaking down to a science in terms of how many words a minute he shot for because it was the most easily understood. I found that fascinating, Douglas.
Well, that's right. He, you know, one of his geniuses, and let's, I mean, if we cut to the chase, what we kind of missed about Walter Cronkite's his voice. It wasn't just a voice of authority or a homespun voice, but it just had something about it very unique and soothing, and it drew you in. And I was trying to get to the secret of that, and I came to the conclusion it was that he had trained himself to be as slow as a muddy old river. Just even on this interview with you, I've been talking fast. I want to cram in a lot of information. But actually, NPR does a good job of this, too, when you give news. You break it down. You talk slowly and directly, and Cronkite would do that. So it wasn't filled with a lot of extraneous things. And, in fact, some of his best broadcasts on special events, he would be quiet for a while. He'd just let them rocket. You know, go up to what's more dramatic than being quiet and watching the rocket head for the heavens. While other people would babble through all of that, Cronkite had learned how to time and pace things. And he trained himself to do that. He never wanted too many words crammed into a minute. He would take a stopwatch, a watch which was his most precious possession, and would constantly time himself so he kind of could create a flow in his broadcast.
Hmm. Let's go to Randy in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Randy.
Good morning. Personal note to Mr. Brinkley, I just spent a little time, a few days in Medora, North Dakota earlier this summer, where you're definitely a big shot.
I love Medora.
I can still remember. Over, a little over 30 years ago when Dan Rather was taking over as anchor, and Yorker ran a cartoon where a figure saying, "Welcome to the CBS Evening News," without Walter Cronkite. My question, though, is that to whatever extent you can say that Cronkite's editorial comment about the Tet Offensive, you know, led to LBJ resigning and everything, and certainly 1968 was a year that was made for TV, I'm wondering, had he ever done anything, had he ever done a comment like that before? Did he do any afterwards? And was he taken aback by just how much influence he ended up having?
Well, can you hold that comment in thought, and let's hear that comment for those who aren't familiar with it. This is Walter Cronkite. He went to Vietnam to find out how the war was going, and this is part of what he had to say.
To say that we are closer to victory today is to believe, in the face of the evidence, the optimists who have been wrong in the past. To suggest we are on the edge of defeat is to yield to unreasonable pessimism. To say that we are mired in stalemate seems the only realistic, if unsatisfactory, conclusion. On the off chance that military and political analysts are right, in the next few months, we must test the enemy's intentions in case this is indeed his last big gasp before negotiations. But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could. This is Walter Cronkite. Good night.
Douglas. Your comments.
Well, you mentioned with the Kennedy assassination, I get chills whenever I hear that. Look, as a young reporter during World War II, and we were all in it together in the Second World War, meaning print reporters were all kind of Ernie Pyles. You were trying to say, you know, our boys are going to lick, you know, Hitler in battle, and it was propaganda for the Allied cause. The 60s were different. Starting in 1965, CBS started showing, putting American policy and sometimes even our soldiers in questionable light. Not often, but there would be a report by Morley Safer, for example, about our Marines burning innocent, you know, Vietnamese villages down, etc. But 68, with the Tet Offensive, which is the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong's wreaking havoc in South Vietnam and even attacking our embassy, Cronkite got on a plane and went all over the countryside, interviewed everybody he could, and came back with a long conclusion, which was called a report from Vietnam. You played a little bite of it. And it was a very important moment. The date was February 27, 68, and Cronkite had turned dove, if you'd like. You know, you can hear it was a lot of nice language there about we were honorable and it wasn't a victory, let's get out to the negotiating table. But the nut of it was that Cronkite said this is a lost cause. And he was suddenly admired by the anti-war left. The hard right, the real hawks, didn't mind because he seemed to be attacking Lyndon Johnson. And Lyndon Johnson himself decides not to run for re-election just a couple weeks after the Cronkite broadcast. Not due to Cronkite, but due to his bad health and a general fear that came at him from 100 directions that this war in Vietnam had gone aground. But the Cronkite moment, as it's called, is quite significant. And for Cronkite, as a personality like him, to lose that role of being Mr. Objectivity, Mr. Center, and speak out tells you how morally outraged he was by what was happening in Vietnam.
Did he hash over whether or not he should say this? Did he talk about why he did it and how it was out of form for him too? So of course people are going to take notice of this journalist doing this.
Well, he did, and I've had to. He was worried that it was going to cost him his job. Mm. There was talk before he went to Vietnam, when he was in Vietnam, and when he came home with the key people at CBS that this could be a career killer for Cronkite. He felt that he needed to do it, that he had earned the credibility to do it, and that it didn't matter. He wouldn't be able to live with himself anymore to think that we were dropping bombs on Vietnamese villages and killing civilians for no real clear cause. And so he spoke out, and in his view, that's what you do in a democracy, and that he had to be a man of conscience ahead of being an anchor man. And he did, and history smiles on Cronkite largely for doing it. His analysis was pretty correct, what you just played. We were mired in a stalemate. What's unfortunate is that the war didn't end in 68, but it drug on for many more years.
Is it true that President Johnson said, if I've lost Cronkite, I've lost the country?
He said something to that effect. There's a bit of a scholarly debate over exactly what was uttered. That the key to that quote comes from Bill Moyers, and it also was echoed by a George Christensen. But whether he ever said something that succinctly, it's whether you believe Moyers or not. But what is clear, what's undisputable from about a dozen people around the president, is that he was deeply disturbed by the Cronkite report, that it was just another straw on the camel's back, that the people of the heartland now was to, even the Cronkite Center was starting to turn against his war policies, and it meant problems.
Thanks, Randy, for your great call. Brad is next. Hi, Brad.
Hi there. Yeah, regarding Cronkite's comments on the Vietnam War, I feel that the media today has been so cowed or intimidated by the right wing that would never make such a claim for fear of being accused of bias. Now what the media does is they just simply report, well, the Democrats say this, Republicans say that. Who's to know what the truth is? You decide. And we don't. It's really a disservice to the public. We don't really get an objective assessment of what's going on. Most Americans don't even know policies that led to this great recession that we're in now. And I'd like the guest to comment on that, the difference between the media back during Cronkite's day and now. I think it's a result of 20 years of the right wing putting forth this meme that the media has a left-wing bias, which is inaccurate, but I really think it's intimidated the media, including WPR and NPR, I might add.
Douglas.
Well, you have to always remember, I mean, CBS in the 60s and 70s was just fantastic. I mean, they had opened up foreign bureaus everywhere. Today, most of those bureaus are closed. Part of the worst part of modern media is the lack of resources given to foreign news. And by you just shut all these, if CBS hadn't opened a Saigon bureau and sent all these photographers and camera people there, we would have been in the dark about Vietnam. Well, today they just don't have the money. The money goes to star anchors or star, you know, people or entertainment shows, and the news divisions have been quite gutted. It doesn't mean we don't have great reporters still out there all over, and they come up on cable news shows and the network news shows and NPR in many places, fantastic reporters. But I agree with the caller. There seems to be a entertainment has eaten up so much of our news space that in a half an hour, you know, suddenly Lindsay Lohan is the headline
news. Oh, please help
news.
Us. I know.
Not our soldiers in Afghanistan. So it's been, things have gotten very skewed, and I don't think for the good of our country.
And yet CBS, I think you write this in the book, toward the end of the book, has returned to a more serious news broadcast with Scott and Charlie Rose in the morning. They're defining themselves, I think, as slightly different, more serious, more substantial.
Well, that's true. I mean, it came because they became rating losers in a lot of their shows. The evening news, CBS was coming in third, and the morning shows third. And a new president of CBS, a young guy in his 30s named David Rhodes, decided, look, CBS needs to go back to its brand, the brand of Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite, about serious news. We're not going to do much worse in the ratings by playing this entertainment game. And so they've stabilized, and now you have a CBS morning show with Charlie Rose and, Erica Hill and Gail King. That's very credible, and they do serious and good interviews in the morning. And CBS Evening News with Scott Pelley, they pay Scott so much less than they paid Katie Couric that they're using some of that extra money resources to do more international news. So CBS Today is trying, and of course they've had 60 Minutes since 1968, which does our country a great service every Sunday by doing serious investigative pieces.
Mm-hmm. You can't talk about Walter Cronkite without talking about space. The book has a very amusing and interesting story of Walter Cronkite campaigning to be the first journalist in space. But we think about him in terms of looking at important issues. And remember all of the space exploration that took place. We'll talk about Walter and space reporting. But first, we need to hear Walter Cronkite on the moon landing.
Good morning. Man is about to launch himself on a trip to the moon from this Florida launch complex. Astronauts Armstrong, Collins, and Aldrin sitting there atop the great Saturn rocket in their command module. My palms are sweaty.
That's, you're now a member of the mission launch team.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
What a moment. Man on the way to the moon. It seemed that the whole world stopped. This man set out on the adventure to escape from his own planet and to set foot on a distant one. The lunar module cutting itself free from the command module, beginning the maneuvers which should place it on the surface of the moon.
We're home.
Man on the moon.
What?
Okay, we're going to be busy for a minute.
There he is. There's a foot coming down the step.
I'm at the foot of the ladder.
Armstrong is on the moon.
Yeah,
Neil Armstrong, 38-year-old American, standing on the surface of the moon on this July 20th, 1969.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Well, for thousands of years now, it's been man's dream to walk on the moon. Right now, after seeing it happen, knowing that it happened, it still seems like a dream. Man has landed there, and man has taken his first steps there. I wonder just what there is to add to that.
What is there to add to that? You could tell this man loved doing space stories, just loved it. And I love the comment that his palms were sweaty as he was watching the liftoff. My palms are sweaty. It's like he was in there with him, isn't it, Douglas?
Well, it's why people loved Walter Cronkite so much. You know, just even he already, you got me drawn in just listening to that little bit of it. I wanted to hear more.
Yes.
He was able, he's always seeming very real, and he was when it came to space. Remember I mentioned during World War II he had embedded with Army Air Corps pilots, and that's military aviation. So after Sputnik in 1957 and the space race began in earnest with the Soviet Union, Cronkite started claiming Cape Canaveral, Florida as his beat. Now, Cape Canaveral's legendary to all of us listening, but when Cronkite started going down there in the late 50s, I mean, it was weed-infested, you know, mosquito-ridden Central Florida. It did not seem like a place to launch your career in broadcasting. Hmm. But Cronkite believed firmly in what was happening, and he wrote, as I mentioned, Alan Shepard and John Glenn's Missions to Glory, and he became like the eighth astronaut. I've been in diners down in Florida where you'll see only pictures of the astronauts and then Walter Cronkite. NASA took him in fully. He became one of his greatest skills was he knew how to break down complex science for the average person without dumbing it down. Now, Carl Sagan knew how to do this, and, you know, Jacques Cousteau did that for oceanography. But Cronkite was very good on taking complicated things and letting us understand it in layman's fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Tougher than you think, what he did. But he then always kept a boyishness about him. And so going to the moon, he let us feel his excitement, whether it was the sweaty palms or his oh gosh and gollies in between all the erudition.
And you got to tell the story of his incredible campaign to be the first journalist in space, and the story of when the spacesuit is delivered to his house. It's hysterical.
Well, Cronkite, I mean, this is truly he wanted to go into space. I mean, call those people what I'm not one of them. The thought of being in a capsule, and that I'm claustrophobic in a way, so that does not sound
I
want to do.
I'm with you.
But Cronkite was one of them who wanted to be up there. He really wanted to see Earth from that perspective of space. So after he retired as anchorman, he went on an old, you know, no-holds-barred campaign with NASA that they would shoot him up into space, and he was going to become the first journalist in space. And it got to the point that the joke you're talking about is a man named David Friend, who now works for Vanity Fair, but was then the photographer, editor of Life magazine, flew up to Martha's Vineyard with a spacesuit, the official one that was purloined from a commissary at NASA, and they brought it for Cronkite, and he wore it and was walking around Martha's Vineyard, Edgartown, dressed up like an astronaut for a photo shoot to try to really show NASA just how committed and ready, raring and ready to go he was. Well, he made the very short list, and in fact, I've interviewed people in NASA. I mean, he was about to be named this when the Challenger disaster occurred, and that set this whole idea of civilians in space back. And by the time Cronkite's billet may have come when John Glenn went back to space, Cronkite had a heart surgery, and from a medical point of view was no longer eligible, and it was his greatest disappointment in his life that he never was able to go to space.
Douglas Brinkley is our guest this hour. His book is Cronkite, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene. Officers also reportedly chased and fired on a radio-equipped car containing two white men. Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street. In the friend's words, the bullet exploded in his face. Police, who have been keeping a close watch over the Nobel Peace Prize winner because of Memphis' turbulent racial situation, were on the scene almost immediately. They rushed the 39-year-old Negro leader to a hospital where he died of a bullet wound in the neck. There was shock in Harlem tonight when word of Dr. King's murder reached the nation's largest Negro community. Men, women, and children poured into the streets. They appeared dazed. Many were crying. A young Negro said, Dr. King didn't really have to go back to Memphis. Maybe he wanted to prove something.
I think of all the news that was delivered by Walter Cronkite, what a time that was in American history. And I'm also reminded, Douglas, of Bobby Kennedy in Indianapolis and that beautiful speech that he gave that calmed Indianapolis after King's assassination. And then I'm reminded, and you write about this, of Cronkite's affinity for Bobby Kennedy and maybe breaching journalistic ethics when he talks to Bobby about running for president on an anti-war platform. Can you discuss that?
Well, after February 27th of 68, after his famous dissent in Vietnam, Cronkite went to Washington to see Bobby Kennedy. And according to Frank Mankiewicz and Ethel Kennedy, and Cronkite, it's known that they met, but they claim that Mr. Cronkite said to Bobby, why don't you run for president of the United States, in which RFK said to Cronkite, well, all right, why don't you take my seat in New York? There was a bit of jocularness about this, but in truth, Cronkite was this disturbed about the Vietnam War policy that he was weighing in an area that normally he wouldn't, meaning to get Bobby Kennedy to run. What was going on here? Well, what was going on here was 1968, where things were coming apart at the seam, and people that had turned on Vietnam had really turned on it, and for sane reasons, the thought that Lyndon Johnson was going to seek re-election to continue his Vietnam War policy was not acceptable to many Democrats. And they, of course, looked for RFK and some to Eugene McCarthy to take an anti-war position into the national election. You mentioned, of course, Bobby Kennedy's assassinated. You played the King murder clip. Just to look at all that went on.
I know.
And by the end of the year, there was Nixon standing in Walter Cronkite. They were still the two titans at year's end. And as I write in the book, from 69 onwards, Cronkite and Nixon are at war with each other. And, of course, I write a great deal about Watergate and Cronkite's role in that and how under Chuck Colson and the Nixon White House, they start an attempt to destroy Cronkite.
Right. Bob in Madison, hi.
My parents were, I was a teenager during that time, and my parents were what you call rock ribs. Country Club Republicans, they hated Cronkite.
Really?
And,
what? Why?
There are a lot of people who associated with them also hated Cronkite. And I wonder if in the guest book, he deals at all with, the fact that he was controversial. He was well-loved, but he was also, by his detractors, he was really hated.
Hmm. Douglas?
Well, there became a saying, Cronkite is communist. Lyndon Johnson himself, according to Merle Miller, had said that at one point. The remarkable thing is it never affected his ratings, which were always sky high. But there were groups of people that learned to dislike Cronkite immensely. One group, of course, the extreme right, didn't like him. And he had done a broadcast that I deem unfair, journalistically unfair, to Barry Goldwater. And Goldwater did not have any use for Cronkite, at least the Cronkite of the 60s and 70s when they were elders. They patched that up. So you have that right group of Goldwaterites, John Birch people that couldn't stand him. And then you had a strand of Southern CBS affiliate owners who hated the civil rights stuff that CBS was doing. They called CBS the colored broadcasting system.
Oh, goodness.
Or the communist broadcasting system. So you lost that group. And then there were just some rock rib Republicans who just said, you know what, Cronkite's broadcast does have a liberal bias. It may not be liberal in all of its, you know, its first 10 minutes of straight news or reporting on a flood or something, but the back end of that half an hour show always seemed to be promoting peaceniks, anti-war, environment, women's rights, gay rights, basically the progressive agenda. And so they thought Cronkite was a liberal, masquerading as an objective centrist. So there was a group of people that never liked him. However, the majority of the Americans did.
Hmm. Thank you, Bob, for the call. Facebook comment, thanks to Mr. Brinkley for his great book. This is from Eric. I listened to it on audiobook, and I'm starting it for a second time right away. I was wondering if he could talk more about the tense relationship between Cronkite and Murrow.
Well, there was no love lost between the two men. First off, Cronkite used to love Edward R. Murrow, although his real radio hero was Lowell Thomas. But Murrow's broadcast from Europe were revelations about what was happening in 39 and 40. And Cronkite was in Kansas City, a consumer of Murrow. And during World War II, they got to meet. In fact, they had a lunch at the Seville Club, a great old-style British gentlemen's club that Rudyard Kipling and Thomas Hardy, Charles Darwin had once been members of. And at that table, Murrow offered Cronkite a job with CBS to be bureau chief in Stalingrad during the war. Cronkite gave a handshake agreement, yes, Mr. Murrow, I'll work for you, and then went back to his hotel and had second thoughts. He didn't want to give up London for Stalingrad. And then he started feeling guilty. He was abandoning all of his United Press pals. And finally, UP offered him a raise. So he reneged on Murrow, and Murrow never really forgave him. And it deteriorates from there. When they worked together in the 1950s, there was zero chemistry. And in fact, Murrow liked documentaries on television, but he could not stand political coverage, particularly conventions, which Murrow perhaps correctly deemed infomercials. Cronkite became a master of doing that kind of gavel-to-gavel live TV coverage. And radio was starting to die out, and TV was on the ascent. And you have almost simultaneously Cronkite becoming anchor when Murrow had left CBS to work for Kennedy, the Kennedy administration, as head of USIA. Murrow dies in 1965, and it wasn't so bad that Cronkite didn't go to the funeral. He did. But you can never call Cronkite a Murrow boy or even somebody that Edward R. Murrow liked.
We're almost out of time. Jim in Milwaukee, hi.
You know, and all I love Walter Cronkite, just love him. And all the discussions that everybody has on him, nobody ever mentions his show in the early 60s, The 20th Century. And I remember it distinctly from when I was a kid, and I loved it, and I would love to see CBS do a rebroadcast. That's all. Thanks very much for the show and the topic.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you. Douglas.
Well, it's a great call. The 20th Century was a remarkable show. And I'll tell you, it was so well done. The writing was so good. Cronkite traveled all over the world for that program. And it was just, in my view, what we need in television more, kind of prime time news shows that are really fact-based and non-sensational, but... and they did a lot of the 20th Century on technologies. Here's a new technology, happening. And it's just a fantastic program. The caller's right. And he needs to know I write about the 20th Century a great deal in the book, yet you're the first person to really ask me about it. But thank you for that.
Mm. Oh, you write about so much. There's so much we didn't get to. Your book is just so thorough, Douglas, and fascinating. I thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you, and I really enjoyed being on the show.
Good. We enjoyed having you. The book is titled Cronkite, Douglas Brinkley, and Douglas Brinkley is a professor of history at Rice University and a contributing editor to Vanity Fair. Believe me, this is one very, very thorough book, and it was, he says in the afterword, prompted by, I think, a car ride he was on with David Halberstam, and they started talking about the big events of the 20th century and how Walter Cronkite was the voice of those events for so many years. So thanks so much to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers for production work. We'll be with you tomorrow. Here's Walter to say farewell.
That's the way it is. Monday, November 25th, 1963. This is Walter Cronkite. Good night.